PPI.org.
Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone.
Hey. Dr. Paul Draws is in the studio with us, and Dr. Draws is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Renal Disease and Hypertension at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And he's in the studio tonight talking about the subject CKD, or chronic kidney disease. Amber Washington Howard is also with us in the studio, and she's going to be telling her story from the side of somebody who's living with the disease. Good evening, Amber.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us. All right. So can we start out by, Paul, can you just give us some history, a little bit about you? And when you went through medical training, how did you decide on the whole renal area? Why did you decide that was your thing?
Okay. Again, thank you for having me here.
You're very welcome.
It's exciting to be here on World Kidney Day.
And, is so it really?
It is World Kidney Day today.
You share that with Pi Day.
Yes, Pi Day.
Exactly. So I was born and raised here in the Twin Cities. I grew up in St. Anthony Village and went to school at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Growing up, I knew that I wanted to be a physician. I was injured often, requiring stitches, and I always found going to the doctor to be fascinating. And so that was the beginning of my interest in medicine. And then in medical school, my interest ranged from orthopedic surgery to internal medicine. I quickly realized that I was interested in physiology, how the body works, and specifically the kidneys, the electrolyte abnormalities, the volume, chronic kidney disease, and the different conditions that affect the kidney were all of great interest to me. So I went on and did internal medicine training, nephrology fellowship at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and moved back here to the Twin Cities in 2012 and have been there ever since.
Wow. Okay. Excellent. Can you give us a little bit of a simplistic definition of what is chronic kidney disease?
So chronic kidney disease is a decrease in function of the kidneys. The kidneys do a lot of different things, from moderate volume, and it does this by holding on to or excreting sodium, keeping electrolytes within normal range, things like potassium, calcium, phosphorus. The kidneys also excrete hormones like EPO that tell the bone marrow to create red blood cells, and they convert inactive vitamin D to active vitamin D. And so the filtering component of the kidneys is what we're most familiar with, and we assess that by measuring creatinine in the blood. And creatinine is produced by muscle. It's excreted by the kidneys. The muscle produces it at a constant rate. And so by measuring the creatinine level in the blood, we're able to assess kidney function.
So there's probably several things that can cause the kidneys to start malfunctioning or not working properly. But what would you say some of the top things are that would start causing CKD?
Okay, that's a really good question. There's really top two, and that would be diabetes and hypertension. Mm-hmm. And then there's a number of other things that can cause chronic kidney disease, like family history, cardiovascular disease, recurrent urinary tract infection, and then more uncommon disorders like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. But the two main causes are diabetes and hypertension. And we know this because people who go on to dialysis, we keep track of the cause of their end-stage kidney disease. And about 50% of people who start dialysis in this country have diabetes as their cause, and about 30% have hypertension as their cause of end-stage kidney disease.
And the other 20% have some hodgepodge of stuff?
Exactly. Family history, cardiovascular disease, kidney stones, a genetic component to their kidney disease.
What is, I've heard this topic, this initials thrown around. What is GFR, and is it something that's measured?
So that's a good question. GFR is glomerular filtration rate.
Okay.
And so that's can be measured, but it's cumbersome. And so we estimate GFR, glomerular filtration rate, based on the lab that I mentioned previously, the creatinine value. We also use gender, race, and age to estimate GFR. And this is how we stage kidney disease or the severity of kidney disease. So GFR normal is over 60. Chronic kidney disease is less than 60. Moderate to severe would be less than 30. And severe chronic kidney disease is a GFR less than 15.
So you measure the GFR, and you say that even gender and even race can have different GFRs, so even if you have normal kidney function. So are you telling me that, like, somebody of, if there's a Caucasian person and African-American person, and they're the same age, and they have functioning kidneys, can they have different levels of GFR then?
That's true. So if you have an individual with the same creatinine value, so that's what we measure in the blood. An older individual who's female might have a different GFR than a younger male who is African American. And so those variables go into the calculation of GFR, but the main determinant is the creatinine value in the blood.
Could you talk about the different stages of CKD? Before you do that, can you talk a little bit about, like, what the beginning signs of CKD might be?
Sure. Unfortunately, there are no early signs of chronic kidney disease. People with mild and even moderate chronic kidney disease are asymptomatic for the most part.
Wow.
At later stages of CKD, so this would be moderate to severe, where the GFR typically is less than 30, mm-hmm. normal again being more than 60. The signs would be fatigue, nausea, loss of appetite, difficulty sleeping, and itching.
Oh my, wow. So this leads me to, like, you know, when somebody gets their yearly exam, like, males don't always do this, but often females do. At least, don't they measure something, or isn't there blood drawn or urine samples taken or anything that kind of measures or can trigger this?
So most individuals who have a condition like diabetes or hypertension will have their creatinine measured. People who are on medications where kidney function is important for dosing the medication will also have labs drawn to have their kidney function assessed. But normal, healthy individuals, middle age, don't necessarily need to have their creatinine measured or a urinalysis to look for protein or blood in the urine, and that would be two other markers of kidney dysfunction. So while the majority of patients who go to see their physician who are on medications or have diabetes or hypertension should have their kidney function assessed with both the creatinine and a urinalysis, it's not necessarily the case that everyone that goes to see their doctor for a well visit is going to have creatinine measured and their kidney function assessed.
Okay. So now we can talk a little bit about stages and what one should expect.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So with mild chronic kidney disease and even mm-hmm. moderate CKD, which is the acronym, there's going to be very few patients who have symptoms from their kidney disease. But in the advanced stages, symptoms are fatigue, nausea, loss of appetite, difficulty sleeping, itching can be a symptom. And this is difficult because a lot of times people will have multiple conditions, and fatigue, nausea, loss of appetite aren't necessarily specific to chronic kidney disease.
It could sound like a lot of things.
Right.
Being pregnant could be one of them.
That's true.
That's just interesting that, some of these things, it feels like that could be anything.
Mm-hmm. And that makes it difficult, especially when we're assessing patients in the hospital who have, again, multiple conditions. Mm-hmm. Liver disease is a good example that can have symptoms that cross over with chronic kidney disease.
Paul, can you tell us how common is CKD? It sounds like, well, go ahead and I'll tell you what I've heard. So go ahead and tell us how common.
So, again, it's associated with diabetes and hypertension, and both of those are increasing in prevalence in the United States. So we're seeing an increasing prevalence of CKD. Approximately 7% of U.S. adults have chronic kidney disease, so that's 30 million adults in the United States. And I was just reading, given that it was World Kidney Disease Day, mm-hmm. That nearly 800 million people worldwide have chronic kidney disease.
Man. And I've heard that, like, a lot of people just, you can have it for a while without knowing. Like, the beginning stages, you can go through for a while and not even know. Is that correct?
That's correct. So in normal individuals who have kidneys that are functioning regularly, mm-hmm. the GFR that we talked about
right.
earlier starts out in the 60s to 90s.
Okay.
Will go down by about 1 unit per year. In people with chronic kidney disease, it will vary. Most patients with CKD, the GFR will go down by 1 to 5 units per year. And so over 20 or 30 years, some people's CKD will go from a GFR of 55 to 35, and they may never have symptoms.
Gotcha.
And so there can be a long, slow course to chronic kidney disease. Others, if their blood pressure is poorly controlled or their diabetes is poorly controlled or they have acute kidney injury, mm-hmm. Then they might have a more rapid decline in their kidney function.
And is the CKD prevalent with all types of diabetes? Does it matter which type?
It's present in both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, yes.
Is there a gender preference for chronic kidney disease?
Good question. It is slightly more common in females than males.
Is there a race preference?
It is slightly more common in African Americans, Hispanics, and this might be genetic, especially for African Americans. There's a gene called APOL1. And it is associated with chronic kidney disease and end-stage renal disease in African Americans. There might also be a socioeconomic component, and a few studies have demonstrated, like many conditions, that low socioeconomic status is associated with increased risk for chronic kidney disease.
Is that because it might be a difference in diet and exercise and what? What else?
Whatever it could
else.
Be diet and exercise. There's a study from the Southeast United States, from Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, that showed that much of the racial disparities associated with stroke and hypertension mm-hmm. is associated with increased salt in the diet.
Mm.
So that might be part of the explanation for the disparities in chronic kidney disease as well.
Is there a margin of age where CKD tends to hit?
Yeah, the data show that while overall 7% of U.S. adults have chronic kidney disease, those over the age of 65, that's about 35% of individuals have chronic kidney disease. And so aging and chronic kidney disease go hand in hand. Again, normal individuals will have a decline in their kidney function. And so it's only natural that with age, some people's decline in kidney function will be more rapid, and that prevalence of chronic kidney disease is greater in an older population.
Obviously, it can hit quite young.
Correct, correct. And some of the diseases that can cause chronic kidney disease at a younger age include inherited conditions, recurrent urinary tract infections, and then some of the less common diseases like lupus that I mentioned earlier.
So I suppose this doesn't really have anything to do with it, but it has the word kidney in it. Do kidney stones have anything to do with it?
They do.
Ah.
And kidney stones can cause obstruction. They can cause damage. They can cause inflammation. People who have kidney stones are at increased risk for chronic kidney disease.
And would they be worried about their GFR? Should they be? Should they be watching that?
They should. And there are things that people can do to avoid recurrent kidney stones. And that includes some medications. So people who have kidney stones should go to see a nephrologist, a kidney doctor. Mm-hmm. But also increased fluid intake. So increased intake of water can dilute out some of those factors that cause kidney stones.
Wow. So can you reverse CKD, or can you reverse any of the damage that it does?
So not all patients who have chronic kidney disease will have a progressive course. Some people do recover. Unfortunately, we don't have any treatments that are known to reverse chronic kidney disease. We do have some treatments that are known to slow the progression of the disease, and this includes treatment of diabetes. And mm-hmm. so patients who have diabetes should target their A1C. So this is a measure of control of diabetes to the range recommended by their physician. This can reduce risk for diabetic retinopathy, so that's diabetes complications in the eyes, and diabetic nephropathy, so that's diabetes complications in the kidneys. There are some specific medications for high blood pressure, like angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors and ARBs, angiotensin receptor blockers, that can slow progression of kidney disease, especially in people who have diabetes and kidney disease. Patients with CKD should avoid NSAIDs. So these are medications like ibuprofen, Aleve, Advil, Motrin.
And why is that?
They can directly damage the kidneys. They're associated with increased blood pressure. So both of those accelerate decline in kidney function. Tylenol, acetaminophen, is not in that category and is okay for patients with CKD.
So it makes me wonder, should all of us avoid them?
Well, not necessarily. Not everyone has CKD or hypertension. And for some people, especially folks with joint pain, NSAIDs are very effective at treating the pain.
I see. I'm going to just jump a little bit here. I want to introduce Amber Washington Howard. Good evening, Amber.
Good evening.
I want to thank you. Amber was the one who brought this topic to our attention on Disability and Progress. And we always like to hear, well, we love to hear when people listen, but we love to hear people's comments and suggestions. And she brought this as somebody who's living with the disease. And so, Amber, I wonder if you can tell us your story and how, when you first discovered you were getting sick.
I didn't know I was getting sick. I didn't first discover that I had CKD till 2014. Mm-hmm. I actually had an infection. I had what's called an abscess, and I went in for them to take a look at it and treat it. And I came back home, and I was getting progressively sicker and sicker. So when I went back, they took a deeper look, and that's when they found out I was already in stage 3.
So, Dr. Draws, what does stage three usually mean?
So stage three would be range from mild to moderate chronic kidney disease. And so that's a GFR ranging from 30 to 60. Amber's story is very familiar to kidney doctors. Folks who have infections are at risk for chronic kidney disease from the inflammation. And then antibiotics, which are very fortunate to have. 200 years ago, 150 years ago, if you got pneumonia or if you had an abscess, mm-hmm. it's not likely that you'd survive because we didn't have antibiotics.
Right.
But unfortunately, most antibiotics are potentially damaging to the kidneys and can be associated with acute kidney injury. And some people who have acute kidney injury don't recover and end up having chronic kidney disease.
Okay, so Amber, what was your response when you heard this? Did you understand what they were telling you? Did you have any family history of CKD? What was your original response?
Yes, I did understand what they were telling me. Unfortunately, it is prevalent in African-American women. So my mother also did have CKD, and she passed away from it. So it was very frightening, of course, and very scary, but I was aware of what they were telling me.
And so what did you do? I mean, short of having some horrible thoughts and emotions, I'm sure. What was your feeling of, like, what you would do next?
Just trying to see if I could slow it down as much as possible, trying to change my diet, trying to exercise. They said weight loss, changing your diet, staying on top of your blood pressure meds, and just trying to slow it down as much as I possibly could.
Dr. Draws, how common is this to have it slow down when people are actually really trying to take control of their lives like this?
Right. And again, Amber, it's great to have you here and great to hear, your side of the story. And fortunately, you know, we do have some medications, treatment of diabetes, specific medications for hypertension. For chronic kidney disease, exercise, diet can be effective for reducing the risk for cardiovascular disease.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we don't have much that you can do for the CKD itself. But reducing risk for cardiovascular disease is very important for patients with chronic kidney disease because CKD is associated with increased risk for things like heart attack, stroke, and heart failure.
So the heart's kind of that secondary thing that can have trouble if you have CKD.
Exactly. There is some evidence that a low protein diet can slow progression of chronic kidney disease, especially for people who have protein in their urine. So we recommend that folks have a moderate intake of protein, not the sausage for breakfast, ham sandwich for lunch, and steak for dinner. That is the typical American
Amber's
diet.
Laughing.
So no Atkins diet, huh?
Right.
We kind of talked about how you can go for a while sometimes and not know, but feels like it's Amber's state now, which I want to get into. She's now on dialysis. So she has kind of gone in 5 years from what seems like zero to, you know, five almost. Is her case feels like it's not usual? Yes?
Again, the trajectory of kidney function in people with CKD varies a lot. Some folks who have difficulty controlling their diabetes or get admitted for other conditions like heart failure or a heart attack or pneumonia and are exposed to potential kidney toxins like the antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I want to stress that antibiotics are critical in treating infection. And so I don't want folks to avoid antibiotics just to avoid kidney damage. But if patients are hospitalized or have poorly controlled diabetes, they're more likely to progress. And so the course of CKD can vary. And it's also to comment on something you mentioned earlier, and that patients don't necessarily know that they have chronic kidney disease. Even patients whose doctors have documented in the chart that they do have chronic kidney disease, the majority of them are unaware. And part of this is because it doesn't cause symptoms. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the bang of a diagnosis like cancer or a heart attack. And a lot of patients have multiple comorbidities. So they have diabetes, hypertension, they've had a heart attack, and CKD is just another thing on their problem list, and they may be less aware of that than the other conditions.
So if you have CKD, you should definitely have a nephrologist that you're seeing.
If you have moderate to severe CKD, yes, that's true. There's given the large number of patients who have CKD in this country, those with mild CKD, especially stage 3A, so this would be a GFR of 45 to 60, most, if not all, primary care providers are comfortable taking care of those patients.
Let's talk about dialysis. Dr. Draz, can you kind of give us an idea of how dialysis works?
Sure. And, you know, we're very fortunate as kidney doctors, nephrologists, to have dialysis. It's one of the only treatments for end organ failure that exists in medicine today. And so dialysis is replaces some of the function of the kidney, mostly the filtering. There's a few types of dialysis. The most common is hemodialysis, and so that would be blood dialysis. There's peritoneal dialysis. This is where a dialysis catheter is inserted in the abdomen.
And I actually knew somebody who used to do that.
Okay.
He wasn't on it for very long. He said, too much.
Right. Some people tolerate it. Others don't. So dialysis is technically the filtering of a substance down its concentration gradient across a membrane. And so with hemodialysis, the membrane is the filter that's been produced. Mm-hmm. And we take the blood out using either a catheter that's inserted in a large vein, typically in the neck. We run the blood through the dialysis machine, through the filter, with dialysate, so this would be clean solution on the other side of the filter. The toxins move from the blood into the dialysis. Some substances move from the dialysis into the blood, and then we return the blood through the catheter or what is constructed as a fistula or a graft, which allows us to do dialysis because we need very high blood flow rates in order to do dialysis in an efficient manner.
And this is the own person's blood, right?
Correct.
So it's cleaning it, basically, and taking everything out and returning it.
Exactly. It's removing the toxins that the kidneys would have removed, maintaining balance of things like potassium. We are also able to pull off fluid if patients come in volume overloaded, and this can be associated with elevated blood pressures. So treatment of high blood pressure in a dialysis patient can be effectively achieved with removal of volume with dialysis.
How long does dialysis usually take?
So dialysis is typically done three times a week and on average about 3.5 to 4.5 hours per session. There are options for daily dialysis, and this can either be done in the hemodialysis center, and so this would be either daily, and that's typically nocturnal, so the patients will come in at night, and the dialysis will run overnight, and some patients are able to do dialysis in the home, where they and a family member, spouse, significant other, hook them up to the dialysis machine, monitor the treatment, and they're able to do dialysis in their home.
So is it more wearing on them to do that? Is it harder to do daily dialysis or dialysis in the home?
Not necessarily. The home dialysis patients do quite well, and there's some evidence that they may have even fewer symptoms than patients who get dialysis three times a week.
Is it cheaper?
You know, That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but dialysis itself is very expensive. On average, dialysis patients incur upwards of $70,000 in healthcare costs a year.
Wow, man. So, Amber,
yes.
Talk about your journey with dialysis.
In my experience, dialysis is the harder part of me having kidney disease. I'm doing hemodialysis, so I go in the center through my blood.
Okay.
And I do it 3 times a week, 3 hours. And trying to clean everything and pull it out in that amount of time is really weighing on my body. I thought when I first started that I would be able to still do dialysis and go to work and keep my life pretty much the same. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to keep doing both and I had to stop working. And it's just a really tiring effect on me.
Dr. Draz, is that common?
That I was just going to say that this is a very common experience for some patients. It's and the experience varies for dialysis patients. Many patients have the same experience that Amber does, where they don't feel well because of the kidney disease, mm-hmm. and then dialysis itself can be a shock to the system. Sometimes dialysis patients will feel worse after dialysis than they do on the day that they need dialysis in the morning.
And so, because?
There's a lot of shifts that go on with a 3 or 4 hour dialysis, and so we remove toxins, we pull fluid, do the functions that the kidneys do in normal individuals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but we're only doing that 12 hours a week. And so electrolyte shifts, the removal of toxins, the fluid shifts can cause some patients to have significant fatigue, and some patients have difficulty with cramping on dialysis, but others do okay with it and are able to continue working. And so the experience with dialysis varies significantly, but Amber's experience is not outside of what we expect.
Amber, was there something that made you decide to do hemodialysis as opposed to even to try daily or at-home dialysis?
I would say mainly the catheter. When I first started dialysis, I had a catheter in my chest. It was not comfortable at all. You can't take showers. Had to wrap it with plastic whenever I was in a bathtub. And it just really wasn't a good experience for me. So I decided to rather go ahead and do the hemodialysis. Also, I have a son at home, and I really don't want him to be exposed or seeing me going on dialysis. It's not a great sight, so.
Is the catheter in the chest a common place to put that, Dr. Draws?
It is. When we place a catheter for dialysis, it needs to be in a large vein. And so the two main options are the internal jugular vein in the neck and the femoral vein in the groin. And we prefer the neck as it's less likely to get infected. And unfortunately, most patients start dialysis with a catheter. In part, this is because of the asymptomatic nature of chronic kidney disease, and people don't seek care until later when they have severe CKD. And it's preferable if people are going to do hemodialysis that they start with a fistula or a graft. And this is a connection between an artery and a vein, typically in the forearm, that allows for hemodialysis to be done without a catheter. And fistulas and grafts are associated with reduced hospitalization, reduced infection, and actually improved mortality. So, Amber, it sounds like you've moved on from a catheter to a fistula or a graft?
Yes, I now have a fistula. It's still a little difficult just because I have narrowing in it, so I have to go back every 8 months or so, and they put a balloon and they open it up.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Is that common?
Again, that's common as well. It sounds like Amber is the typical dialysis patients. But congratulations on moving on from a catheter to a fistula or graft. Unfortunately, they don't last forever. You have narrowing, fibrosis, This can be both where the fistula is created, or it can be more centrally located, closer to the heart. And that will make it so that the fistula graft is not as efficient for dialysis. Some of the early signs can be that there's bleeding longer after dialysis than we'd expect. The nurses will have to hold pressure. Fortunately, we do have some interventions that are effective, but many patients have to move from one fistula to another over the course of their dialysis experience.
Amber, how did this affect being a mom? How did you deal with this with your son?
It's a little difficult because he's 11, and as much as you try to explain it, he still doesn't get it totally in full. He really knows that mom's sick, and it's hard because you're trying to tell him, I can't do this today, or I don't feel up to this, or I'm tired, and it's not what he's used to or what he expects.
Right. What kind of things do you do for workarounds?
Are you just for, like, working
just
around the house?
Working or? Around, like, being more tired, or how do you deal with, you know, trying to keep your life as normal as possible?
My biggest thing in trying to keep my life as normal as possible is try to stay as optimistic as I can, trying to focus on little things to do around the house every day. I've started my own kidney page called Love Your Beans on Facebook, where I talk to other people with these symptoms and try to find a common nature with other people, and it just having a joy within myself still.
I'd like to talk about kidney transplantation. And Dr. Dawes, can you speak to that at all as far as how that works?
Sure. And, you know, we're fortunate here at the University of Minnesota to have an outstanding kidney transplant program. Transplant physicians do an extra year of training, and in that year they learn about eligibility for a transplant, eligibility for people donating a kidney, the immunosuppression that's required for transplant, and then the complications after. And so kidney transplantation is actually the preferred treatment for those who have end-stage kidney disease. It's associated with improved outcomes. Obviously, you don't need to be going to dialysis 3 days a week or 6 days a week. You don't need to do peritoneal dialysis. Patients need to be able to tolerate and survive the surgery itself. It's not a major surgery, but not a minor surgery. And so the first thing is to assess whether or not patients are fit enough, well enough. Obviously, they have advanced chronic kidney disease, but the transplant nephrologist will assess for cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and other conditions that affect surgical outcomes.
And so you have to be, quote, a match, right?
Correct. So the kidney will come either from a family member, an acquaintance, a spouse, or we do get kidneys from deceased donors. So patients who have a car accident, have a brain death, their kidneys would be eligible for donation. And the match looks at both the donor characteristics and the patient characteristics, and whether or not the immune system from the recipient will attack the donor kidney despite having the immunosuppression. And so there's certain matches, blood type is an example where it's an absolute contraindication. Others where it's just an immune intolerance where there's not a match, where some are acceptable, but it has to do with the immune system and blood type and the recipient immune system recognizing the donor kidney and rejecting it.
And just so people are aware, it's my understanding that, I mean, it's people are very capable of living with one kidney.
That's true.
So you wouldn't have to die to give a kidney.
Nope. And so that's referred to as a living donation. Mm-hmm. Many people do that every day, both because they know someone with end-stage kidney disease or just for altruistic reasons. And there have been many long chains that are referred to as of kidney transplants where individuals donate to recipients that they don't know. And so people can donate a kidney. There's a slight, very slight increased risk for kidney disease, hypertension, but it's in the range of 0.2% to 0.5%, or about that. So not a significant increased risk. And so if anybody out there is thinking about donating a kidney, I'd encourage them to contact a transplant center near them. And really to encourage people when they're signing up for their driver's license to put down that you're willing to be a donor and volunteer to be a donor. As I think people have probably heard, God doesn't need your kidneys and your organs. You can leave them here for someone who does.
It's very interesting to me. My understanding is in Europe, you have to opt out in order to not donate, be an organ donor. Here you have to opt in. Why is that?
I wasn't aware that there was an opt-out policy in Europe. I was familiar that it's an opt-in here. I think it's legal issues. The culture here has driven that. Mm. I don't know of any reason medically why that would have to be. I think it's purely just a legal issue, and that's how the laws have been written. I think I would advocate for an opt-out policy.
Yes,
if,
me too.
Politicians or voters asked me, but I think that would be a good change.
Amber, I presume you're on the transplant list of people waiting?
Yes, I'm on the transplant list here in Minnesota as well as Iowa. The list is 3 to 5 years long. So that's also another tedious part. You're kind of waiting for this phone call and hoping it comes before something drastic happens.
Can you only get on the list when you're on end stage?
I don't believe that it's only when you're in end stage, no.
Dr. Draws?
No, you can get on the list when your GFR falls below 20.
Oh. Isn't that kind of like that?
Not necessarily. Okay. So a lot of people with a GFR of 18 won't have symptoms. With a GFR less than 20, some individuals will have 2-3 years before they need dialysis. And so they're not necessarily the same. The average GFR, so the glomerular filtration rate when people start dialysis, is between 5 and 10. And so a GFR of 15 or 19 or 20 doesn't necessarily mean that patients need what we call renal replacement therapy, either peritoneal dialysis, hemodialysis, or a transplant.
Amber, how long have you been on the list?
I've been on the list here for 2 years, and I've been on a list in Iowa for about 8 months.
Wow. Okay. I'd like to talk just a little bit about transplant, because I think that's just so vital and important. And can you tell people how to get on the list to be able to donate an organ again, Dr. Dross?
So if you're interested in donating an organ, you should contact a transplant center. And we have Hennepin County and the University of Minnesota here in the Twin Cities. If you're listening elsewhere, you can look online. Most major universities will have a transplant center. If you call the Kidney Transplant Clinic, you can be evaluated as a donor. This involves blood tests to make sure that your kidneys are functioning well and other health screening to make sure that you don't have other conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. But it's a laudable thought. And again, very other than this surgery, which is a moderate surgery, the donating a kidney doesn't necessarily significantly increase your risk for chronic kidney disease, hypertension, or other conditions related to kidney function.
Can a person resume normal life activities once they donate and once they get a kidney?
They can. Both, so donors, the recovery in the hospital from surgery is a few days, and then home probably from work for a week or two, and resuming normal activities within a month with some limitations. But after 6 months, 3 to 6 months, full return of activities after donating a kidney. Kidney recipients, similar, 3 to 4 days in the hospital, and then a few weeks to a couple of months of recovery and rehab. And then, fortunately, they have near normal activity with almost no restrictions, and no longer have to worry about hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis. So, again, transplant, kidney transplant is the preferred treatment for end-stage kidney disease.
How does someone know where they are on the list?
So, again, I'm not a transplant nephrologist, but if you are on the list or and listed and active, that would be with communication with the transplant center, the transplant coordinators, and they would have that information. And then once you've accrued time on the wait list or have a significant time on dialysis and then are on the transplant list, when an organ comes up and you're near the top of the list, you'll get called in, and hopefully the cross match will be acceptable, and the transplant can go forward.
Amber, have you ever been called in, but the match wasn't a match?
No, I haven't been called in as of yet. I've only been on the list about 2 years here. And then to add on, I'm O positive, which is a hard match that they've told me.
Really?
Yes.
Dr. Dras, what would that be?
It has to do with the potential donors and the donor pool and the organs that someone who has an O positive blood type is able to accept. And the wait time does vary by blood type and by center. So what did they tell you your expected wait time would be here?
3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. Okay.
So I'm O positive. And so I thought that was like a really common blood type. And so that would be common to easy to have somebody donate and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the type of blood type that you are, but it also depends on the type of organs that you can receive. And so not all blood types can receive organs from folks with different blood types. And the availability of organs differs. And so that it really goes to what organs can go in which direction and the availability of organs with that blood type.
So now it's just a matter of Amber holding on till she gets a match.
Exactly.
So one thing that I'm curious about is which came first, organ transplants or dialysis, and when did those things happen?
So that's a good question. I don't know when the first kidney transplant was, but it may be that they came about around the same time. Dialysis was first introduced medically in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and has come quite a long way since. And we now have about 500,000 patients or more with end-stage kidney disease in the country, and over 400,000 patients on dialysis, on hemodialysis in the United States. So it's been around for almost 45, 50 years.
So I just recently read that they're being able to now safely grow organs in pigs because they've been able to deal with the antigen or whatever it was that was causing problems between pigs and humans. And so I'm wondering, presumably this should lessen that horrible wait that people are going to have to do?
That's a good question. There's a lot of research in this area with, I believe it's called xenotransplantation.
Yes, thank you for that.
And it's early, but the ability to grow, develop organs in other animals, pigs has been one of the most studied, is on the horizon. I wouldn't say that it's going to be here in the next 5 or 10 years, but someday, hopefully, the critical organ shortage that we experience with kidneys, livers, heart, lung, may be solved by that type of technology.
What about stem cells? Are we doing anything with them, and can they be successful in any type of transplantation?
Another good question. I think that's another area of research that is promising. There's stem cell research where we take the scaffold of a kidney and introduce stem cells, and the hormones and milieu that causes what looks like a kidney to form. And there's cells that have function of cells in a kidney, but we're not to the point where that's the solution for chronic kidney disease. There's other research on stem cells for treating patients with chronic kidney disease, acute kidney injury. But again, that research is early, and I don't see it moving into clinical practice anytime in the next 5 years.
So, Amber and Dr. Draz, I want each of you to tell me, when you hear if somebody was talking and you heard they had just been diagnosed with CKD, or they have just discovered they have been diagnosed for CKD, what would be each of your advice for them?
I would tell them to try to take one day at a time. I know it's going to feel overwhelming and almost to the point as if you can't do it, but just keep up your optimism. Know that you have great people, great support systems out there for people with CKD, and just try to keep your faith and hopes up.
I agree. I think there's a lot of resources out there for people who've just been diagnosed with kidney disease. The National Kidney Disease Education Program has some very good information. The National Kidney Foundation, talking with your primary provider, talking with your kidney doctor, getting your questions answered, I think would be the advice that I have for patients.
And what would be a good way for somebody to find, a good nephrologist?
Well, we think we have a few good nephrologists at the University of Minnesota. So you can call the nephrology clinic at the University of Minnesota. I'm familiar with a number of nephrologists at Hennepin and in the community, many of whom trained at the University of Minnesota. And so we're fortunate here in the Twin Cities to have a lot of great nephrologists.
Do you have a website or something that we can give them?
We do have a website. If you look for University of Minnesota Nephrology, it'll come up.
Amber, can people look at your Facebook page?
Yes, I have a whole Facebook page dedicated to it. It's called Love Your Beans, and anybody is public. Even if you don't have kidney disease, if you want to just share on any disease or disability that you have, I'm open to having anybody come on and write or post.
Dr. Draz, briefly, any studies people can get involved with, and if so, how?
So we're studying chronic kidney disease at the University of Minnesota. I've got a PhD student, Lama Ghazi, who's looking at health disparities as it relates to chronic kidney disease, disparities in prevalence of CKD and patterns of care. Dan Murphy is a nephrology fellow in training. He's studying acute kidney injury in patients outside the hospital. Our new division director, actually been there about a year now, is studying some rare kidney disorders like IgA nephropathy, lupus nephropathy. And in our endocrinology division, Louisa Caramori, And Betsy Sequist are studying diabetes and chronic kidney disease.
So somewhere people can go to get involved with this?
Yes. People can go to the Department of Medicine webpage, to the endocrinology webpage at the University of Minnesota, and the nephrology and hypertension webpage at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you both for being on. I really appreciate it. This has been a fascinating show. So I hope many people listen. And if you have any questions, where can they go?
So, again, the questions about chronic kidney disease, the National Kidney Disease Education Program, the National Kidney Foundation, both have outstanding resources for patients and providers.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Good night. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the host of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. We've been speaking with Dr. Paul Draws. Dr. Draws is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Renal Disease and Hypertension at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He was talking about CKD, or chronic kidney disease. We also had Amber Washington Howard, who is a person living with the disease, in the studio. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you'd like to be on my email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Thanks so much for listening. As always, good night.
KFAI. KFAI. Dot dot org.